Angus Young. How you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl. How you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Yes, welcome back to The Rider. We've had a couple of great weeks of the podcast. You can catch up anytime on all platforms. First of all, Tim Rogers from UMI. What a bloke. What an absolute national treasure. And that Nick Cave story was bloody hilarious as well. You can catch up on that now. And last week was Novak from Polish Club. One of my favourite bands. Seen them countless times. I photographed them. And he gave you some brilliant advice when it comes to what you put on your rider. That is on now on catch up. But this week on the podcast, a legend of the music industry. He has been on tour with AC/DC. He's brought out ABBA. He's brought out Fleetwood Mac. He got onto Robbie Williams way before everyone knew who Robbie Williams was. And he's one huge part of the Australian music industry. I'm talking about Michael Chugg. And there's a lot to cover off. So it's going to be a two-part episode of this podcast. And let's see if he's coming through right now on Zoom. There he is. His screen is up. Hey, Chuggy.
Hi, Chris.
Chuggy. Good to see your face.
Yeah, you too.
Welcome to The Rider, Michael Chugg. How are you?
Good, Chris. Yeah, very good.
Mate, you looking well. You're in.
Yeah, I'm in Phuket at my house in Phuket with my partner. I've been here for a couple of weeks.
And how's the COVID thing been going?
Every day for 2 years now. Just can't plan anything. The amount of shows and concerts we've moved around and still moving around is quite amazing, really.
Has it been the hardest year for touring you've ever experienced? Is that
hasn't been any touring, basically. I mean, a couple of the Chugg Music acts, Casey Barnes and Shepherd, live in Queensland, so they've been able to do stuff up there. Lime Cordial have probably done a dozen shows in a year. It's tough.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get one of the Lime Cordial ones at the Oxford Art Factory, you know, about this time last year. And it felt special because we're able to see a band, you know, and it was still in the middle of COVID. But
yeah, we had 100 people a night. I think we did 8 shows in 4 days.
Yeah. God.
Yeah, well, it's been tough, you know. It's just, you know, and like we've had to postpone their European tour 3 times. We got like 2 sold-out London shows, 2 sold-out Amsterdam shows.
Oh, mate, tell you what, you've had an incredible career. I mean, I've bumped into you so many times. And the thing I love about you, Chuggy, is, you know, you're not sitting back at home on your couch. You know, there were 2 years ago when gigs were around, I'd bump into you at a small gig at the Oxford Art Factory. It might have been Morgan Evans, I think. And, you know, you're still there. You're still having a cigarette at the front and it's like nothing's changed.
Still having a fag out the front. If Kudinski was still alive, he'd be screaming at me, put that fucking cigarette out. Anyway, you got to get out and about. I don't get out and about as much as I used to, but, you know, it's pretty important. It's very
important. Tell us about the early years growing up in Tassie. You're a kid pretty much, but you straight away thought a great way of making a buck was putting on dances. And that's where this all began.
Yeah, I was, I wanted to be a DJ, and I ended up being a sporting commentator on 70X in Launceston when I was like 14, 15, calling the cycling and the athletics. And I graduated into the trots and the horse racing, the gallops. And I was doing all that. And then I was also a cyclist because growing up in Tasmania, you either played Aussie rules or you rode bikes. And the local cycling club decided to have a charity month where they do a queen of the cycling. And I was working at the time as a junior salesman at a furniture place in Launceston. And the other junior salesman was the bass player, a guy called Rodney de Klerk, who went on to play in the Mixtures, actually. He was playing with Launceston's top band. So I suggested we run a dance. So the cycling club, we booked the trades hall, which is still there in Launceston. And my father used to be, he was a fireman, but he also, had second jobs as an usher bouncer at the local picture theatres. So I got him and his fireman mates to be the bouncers and booked my mate's band and put another young band on that I went on to manage and play a lot of shows with around Tasmania. And we made £80 for the cycling club, which in those days was a small fortune.
It's a heap of money. Yeah.
It was, yeah. So I started then running dances around local church halls in Launceston. The band I was managing was called the Chevrons. And I used to be down at the cycling track broadcasting, and my father would be, him and his fireman mates, up running the dance. So at the end of the cycling, I'd go back, count all the money, give the old man a couple of quid and put the rest in my pocket. It was okay.
Hang on, and you got sacked from the commentating as well, by the way. You got to tell us how that happened.
Oh, you know, there's a few stories about how it happened, but I swore on air one night, and it wasn't my best night either. I was bumbling and fumbling, and I said, you know, a couple of words, and the guy running the station rang me up and said, listen, I love you, but I'm afraid you can't work anymore. So that was that. And I decided,
I think the words were, oh, he's fucking won, or something like that.
No, he's fucking fallen over is one of the stories. That's the most famous one. I won't deny it. So I decided I enjoyed, you know, running dances, booking bands, and that's how I got started. You know, I remember a very famous promoter who became a bit of a mentor for me, a guy called Ron Blackmore, Melbourne guy, used to bring a lot of big bands down to Australia. And I'd go and I'd stand outside the hall and inside the hall and watch what was going on. And I learned, you know, a lot off him. And I finally moved to Melbourne. I'd had a couple of trips across with different acts. And I moved there with a band called Ida May Mac, which featured Tony Naylor, who's one of the top session players in the world and has played with Cliff Richard and Olivia Newton-Johnny, currently plays shows with Brian Cadd and people like that. We moved to South Yarra, and I went into Ambo, which was the big management booking agency, and I saw this young red-headed guy with a big nose sitting down in the back corner, and I went over and said hello, and that's where Michael and I first got together.
And what a partnership that was. And you got to see the early years of so many great musicians as well. I know that, you know, there was Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, obviously.
I was very lucky. I saw Billy was the first concert I ever saw within national acts. He was touring with Screamin' Lord Sutch. We're going way back here. Yeah. He played at the Launceston Albert Hall and he just nailed me to the wall. And he came back a couple of months later and played a show at the National Theatre with Ray Brown and the Whispers, a Melbourne singer called Billy Adams, a Melbourne girl called, Denise Drysdale was on that tour. And I was lucky enough to slyly sneak up to the floor they were staying on and hung out with them for a few hours. And, you know, when I was in Melbourne and I became the poster boy for Gudinski and Browning at Consolidated Rock, Thorpey was coming down from Sydney a lot, and he actually moved to Melbourne just before more arse than class than most people I know. And we became really close friends. And obviously when he came home from America in the 90s, we got back together and started doing stuff. And that was a very sad day when Billy passed. It was 10 years ago. Earlier this year. So, yeah, so Thorpey. Then a couple of months after I saw Thorpey, I went to see a cavalcade of stars at the Albert Hall. And there was this band backing the first half. I think there were singers like Tony Worsley, Lynn Randell again, a whole lot of acts on the bill, and this band were backing them, and I thought, gee, they're a good band. And then the second half opened and the backing band came on and did the most amazing fucking set I've ever seen, Max Merritt and the Meteors.
Wow. Yeah.
So Billy and Max became lifetime friends. And, you know, for me, it was with the beginning of like an incredible time in Australian music, where all of a sudden you had The Chain, who, you know, was a big moment for Michael because he started managing them, got a deal with Festival Records, and our old mate Stan Rowe at 3UZ, the legendary DJ, played The Chain on 3UZ, and all of a sudden The Chain had a fucking top 10 single, and Australian music all of a sudden was back on air. And then, you know, Daddy Cool came out with Eagle Rock and Spectrum with I'll Be Gone and Thorpe's Most People I Know. And all of a sudden there was a whole new music scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, developed into Sunbury, and then along came AC/DC, and I was managing and went around the world with Stevie Wright, who was, it's a whole nother story, that one. He was so close to becoming a worldwide act. He just couldn't keep it together with the drug. There was a lot going on back then.
Sunbury was a massive thing for Australian music. And as you described it there, we just, the momentum kind of went into Sunbury, and you sort of recreated that again many years later with Narara. We'll talk about Narara in a bit, but I want to talk about AC/DC because I've still got posters on the wall, you know, Christmas rock, you know, presented by Chuck Gadinski, I think it was, and you had so many great iconic tours in the absolute early years of AC/DC.
Chug and White, Stephen White it was. Yeah, AC/DC. I was a huge Easy Beats fan, and I remember, like, when those acts used to come to Tasmania, I'd living in Launceston, I'd hitchhike up to Devonport on the Thursday or Friday night to see the bands play. And then I'd see them again in Launceston on the Saturday. And then on the Sunday, I'd hitchhike to Hobart and see them there. And I saw the Easy Beats, the Twilights, the Groove, Normie Rowe. I followed the bands around. And the Easy Beats were a huge favourite of mine. And one day I was sitting in our agency office in Sydney in the early 70s. And the guy, Ray Arnold, who used to work for me, came up in my office. He said, oh, there's a couple of guys downstairs who want to meet you, with you. I said, well, who are they? He said, George Young and Harry Vander. And I went, oh, fuck, okay. So they came in and they asked me if I'd manage Stevie Wright. They were about to release Hard Road, the album, and Evie, the single. So that's where it all began. With the whole Albert's AC/DC. And what happened was Ray Arnold, who I mentioned, he had a real eye for music, and he actually said to me one day, you know, George Young's brothers have got a band called AC/DC. And they had a singer called Dave Evans. And I was in the middle of putting a show together for the Sydney Opera House, the first ever show at the Opera House, rock and roll show with Stevie Wright.
Yeah.
So we booked AC/DC to be the support act. And that was the first show they ever did of any note at the Opera House. And then, you know, Michael Browning, had started Consolidated Rock in Melbourne with Gadinski and had been managing Thorpe, took Thorpe to London, where Thorpe got thrown out of the marquee for being too loud. he'd come home and he came to have a meeting with me. And he said, so what's hot? Any hot bands I should have a look at? And I told him about George's young brothers, AC/DC. So Browning went and met with him and started managing AC/DC. And he's the one who took them to London and to America and really got it all going. And so, yeah, there was a fair connection there. And I remember, you know, when they did their first, was it High Voltage? We had a flatbed truck, and they played on the back of the flatbed truck driving down Burke and Collins Street in Melbourne.
Oh, it's a long way to the top. That was and I think Molly might have been involved with that for Countdown.
Yeah, Molly was around. Molly was always around.
He was always around. I mean, yeah. I was talking to a mate of mine, Dave Carlson, who you might remember. He worked for you, and he was on the road with AC/DC as the absolute junior kid who would just go there to help them out and make sure they got to the gig on time. And
Dave, yeah. We were, in those days, we used to do a lot of shows out of Sydney. We'd do a run into Orange, Bathurst, Cowra, Parks, Dubbo. And Dave and his mate used to go out 3 or 4 weeks before in an old car full of handbills and posters and promote the shows and go to the local radio stations. And, yeah, you know, Dave and I go way back.
What a job, though, as a 17-year-old going on the road with AC/DC and having Bon Scott buy you alcohol. And I think he even told me he was introduced to groupies as well while they were there.
Yeah, we won't get into that these days. You don't talk about groupies anymore.
Yeah, yes.
We don't need to open any doors here.
So that was AC/DC, and you were right in the beginning of that. And actually, who were you drawn to when you saw them for the first time? Was it Malcolm, the leader, or was it Angus, or was it Bon?
Bon joined later. Dave Evans was like a glam long.
It was glam rock. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it was Angus. Browning put Angus in the school uniform, but it was Malcolm and Angus. I mean, that was, you know, and then they slowly built the band with Phil Rudd and Mark Evans. And then Browning decided they needed another singer. And Bon was living in the Adelaide Hills, getting very stoned with a band called Fraternity. And Browning flew over and talked Bon, because I knew Bon. I used to, when I first moved to Melbourne, I lived in an apartment building in St Kilda Balaclava. And in the same building were the Valentines, Bon and Vince Lovegrove, and some of the Master's Apprentices. So I knew Bon from then. I mean, they were party animals way back. I'll tell you a story, actually.
Yeah.
The guy called Dennis was the tour manager or the roadie for Valentine's. And he said, oh, we're doing a show in Ballarat tomorrow night. Would you and Gadinski like to come along? So we went along to Ballarat in the back of an old, ute with the canopy on the back full of gear and us sitting on the gear. And so we get to Ballarat, we help set the show up, and Vince Lovegrove just couldn't help himself, never could. The stage is surrounded by beautiful young girls, all going berserk. And, of course, Vince has to say, oh, girls, don't worry about your boyfriends, come and see us all after the show. So the show ends. And we have to fight our way out of Ballarat with microphone stands and people chasing us. There's a scene in an Easy Beats documentary where they had to leave town with all the guys in the cars chasing them. I don't know whether you ever saw that, but that's what happened to the Valentines and Gadinski and I in Ballarat.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, that's a long time ago now. So we knew Bon, and he just fitted in like a glove. They went to London and it was all starting to happen and they were starting to get really going. And they were staying at this old hotel and each room was a different theme, antique theme. And I went around there, I was hanging out with Bon and he just got a Maserati. And that night, slightly off our faces, he drove me around Notting Hill. Yeah, that's where it was, Notting Hill. Around Notting Hill and the surrounding suburbs at 120 miles an hour in his Maserati. The most terrifying time I've ever had.
To be there at the beginning must have been incredible. And when you know, the news of Bon in 1980 passing away in London, it must have hit you pretty hard.
It did. It's very sad what happens. I mean, I've been to the cemetery in Perth a couple of times and said hi to him. And I mean, it's incredible how many people go to see his grave in Perth. And they now have a Bon Scott Day. They have a festival at the outside the cemetery and all that. It's quite an amazing thing. And people come from all over the world. Yeah, now I was lucky enough to be involved in the tour when they came back. It must be 7 years now. The first one, not the last tour, but the tour before that, I was involved in that. And that was quite a proud moment because we did. I held the outdoor record at the time with Robbie Williams. We'd done 600,000 people, but AC/DC, we did 720,000 people came to that show, and it was an amazing thing, because you'd see them at the gates and there'd be grandma and grandpa in their black shirts, mum and dad, their kids in their black shirts, and then the tribe of grandchildren and children in their black shirts all coming to see AC/DC. It was amazing.
The thing about, AC/DC, I remember talking to, the people at Albert's, and they always said they always wanted to keep those ticket prices under $100 so the whole family could go, and they were determined to keep it under $100 no matter how much they cost, that's why the families were able to go.
Yeah, I remember when they got banned and they went to London, we did this tour called Lock Up Your Daughters, and we got thrown out of Tamworth and a couple of other towns.
Yeah.
Really heavy headlines. So they went to London. It probably, prematurely put them in London a year before they were ready, but off they went. It was quite funny because back in the early 2000s, I did a tour with Thorpey called Lock Up Your Mothers.
Actually, I have that poster, by the way, the AC/DC Lock Up Your Daughters. I do have that framed. Wow.
Worth a lot of money. That
it might be worth. I got that one and Christmas Rock, and they're both.
Yeah, I did those with Steve White, and I had a company in Sydney called Marquee Attractions. Mm. Steve these days manages the Wolf Brothers and Lee Kernaghan and all that country music. And we had this company. We did tours with AC/DC. We did shows with Thorpey. We did tours with Marsha Hines, Hush, all those in the early 70s. And that was quite a big company before I went back with Ganinski.
Going through the resume of Michael Chugg, there's so many massive tours that meant so much to people over the years. I mean, we'll talk about Fleetwood Mac in a bit, but I want to talk about ABBA, because that sounded like an insane tour, but also it's a miracle it all happened and it didn't go to a disaster pretty much. Tell us about the Sydney gig particularly.
Well, it was quite an incredible tour. I was Paul Daintie's tour director at the time. And I'll never forget, we were on the tarmac at Sydney Airport when they arrived, and they all got off the Qantas plane in their white jackets with ABBA and Qantas and all that. And it looked like you were greeting an international football or some sort of sporting team. They were so together and lovely people. So our first shows were at the Sydney Showground, the old showground, the entertainment quarter as it's called these days. And they had bought a blow up inflatable roof with them. The stage had hydraulics in it. It was, big PA towers. They bought a lot of equipment from overseas. It was a monstrous show. So it took like a week, 5 days to build the stage, and it pissed down. It rained. It was cold rain, middle of summer, cold rain pouring down, building the stage in the rain, and it was just laying down chairs, coming back the next day and all your chairs are floating around. It was just very traumatic, and I'll never forget it. Eric Robinson, the legendary production guy who started and ran Jans, which was the big sound lighting company in this country, still is. He was the production manager, and we're out there one. We were the night before the show. Yeah, I think it was the night before the show. We were starting to hook everything up, the power and everything. And there was a very famous electrician. He's still alive. And he had a stutter, Peter Wilson. Anyway, Eric and I were standing on the back of the stage, and Peter came over and he went, "I'm going over to the lighting tower to hook up the power." And okay, so off he goes. It's still wet. It wasn't raining at that time. Anyway, off he goes. We stand on the back of the stage, and the showgrounds used to have these old scaffold, old lighting towers, about 60 foot tall, and in the bottom of the power boxes. So off he goes. We stand on the back of the stage, and all of a sudden, there's this amazing blue flash goes up the fucking pole. And we go, whoa, and we start running. We run over and we can't find Peter. And it's like, oh, where is he? Peter, Peter. And he's laying about 35 feet away on his back. And he goes, did you fucking see that? The first show comes, the day before the show, actually, Ian Leslie, the famous journo from Channel 9, is trying to get in the ground. And he keeps climbing the fences. And in the end, I've had enough. And I go over, and he's halfway over this fence, and I whacked him. And, we became good friends after that, but I did actually whack him. Anyway, we decide we're going ahead with the show. It's raining. The crowd are coming in with their umbrellas and all the chairs, and the chairs are sinking in the mud. It was like, oh. So we sent back to the hotel. We got because the stage was white. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything was white. So we sent back to the Siebel townhouse, and we got every white towel the Siebel townhouse had so that we could keep drying the stage. And it was quite funny because the ABBA's monitor engineer was Nick Pitts, who's now been the production manager at Frontier Touring since 1980. And the monitor engineer, production manager, was a guy called Keith Bradley, who's now Elton's tour director. So there's a bit of context there.
Anyway,
the show goes on. It's pissing down. We're wiping the stage. One of the girls slips over on a bum, gets up. They continue going on. The orchestra come up on the hydraulics. The crowd are just soaking wet, but just loving it. It was amazing, like really amazing. So anyway, we pack it up. We've got, two or three more shows? And we go back to the hotel. And, of course, the relief is incredible. We're downstairs in the ballroom at the Siebel, and we get totally out of it, drunk and happy. And it was, we'd done it. It was monstrous to do this. All this production, the blow-up roof, just incredible. So anyway, 6 a.m., my phone won't stop ringing. And I pick up the phone, and it's the security guy at the showgrounds. And he says, Chuggy, you need to come down here straight away. He said, I was asleep. My dog woke me up. He said, we've got a problem with the roof. So I rang Eric Robinson and said, get your ass downstairs. We need to go. We go out to the showgrounds, 6:30 in the morning. The sun is beaming down. We feel like shit. And the roof is bent in the middle, full of water. And it's about a foot and a half off wiping out all the equipment and everything on the stage. And if that dog hadn't have started barking, we would have lost everything. The stage, the scaffolding would have fallen down. It was bending already, right? So we deflated the roof, and the show went on the next day that night. But we were very lucky. While we were getting drunk downstairs, the rain had become, they reckon, 5-10 times worse than it had been during the show. So we were very lucky to get out of that one.
That's a great example.
It was amazing. And we did the last shows in Perth. There was a bomb scare. I'll never forget. I had to go on stage and tap Vaughan, who was at the piano, on his shoulder and say, look, excuse me, Mr. Whatever. We need to leave the stage. So in the middle of the show, they go off stage and I have to get on the microphone and walk the Perth Entertainment Centre crowd outside because the police just wouldn't, it's bullshit, officer. You get them out of here now. So we emptied the hall. There was no bomb, but you can't take the risk, obviously. And so they all came quietly back in and we finished the show. We had a great party at the Perth Yacht Club after the last show in Perth. And the next day when they flew out, we were all very, very sad. It was an amazing tour. And they were making a film during that, ABBA, the movie. They made that during the tour. So it was a crazy tour. We had 400 or 500 people on the road. It was just, it was like, It was the start of what was to come. The rock arenas, the Fleetwood Macs, the Bowie MCG show where it rained so heavily after the show. The scaffolders had to go in and build a scaffolding bridge from the stage to the loading dock so we could get the equipment out. Because the ground was 4 foot underwater, so we could get the equipment out to get to Sydney in time. Just all that incredible. It was a really incredible time. Paul Daney was an amazing promoter and taught me everything. And one of the most important things he taught me, which became, well, Michael Gudinski and my, I suppose it was our main thing. It was always the main thing, the most important thing, was to look after the artists. And Dainty taught me that, and we took that on, obviously.
It's all based on relationships, you know, and I know Michael had that with bands like the Foo Fighters, you know, they always toured with him, and you had the same relationships with so many who, you know, you brought them back again and again and again.
No, that's right. I mean, Robbie Williams is a good example, and I mean, obviously Elton's last tour, which, I mean, Buddha was shining on me when that tour finished 7 days before COVID. You know, so it's, it's been a lot of relationships thing. When Mike and I split up in 2000, I started Chug Entertainment. We actually, you know, that band went with Michael, that band went with me. There was no bullshit, no fighting over it. And I was lucky for a couple of years that Michael was more interested in Mushroom Records and a couple other things, starting to make movies and shit. So I got under the wire and got a few tours done before he decided to get back into Frontier.
Was that your toughest decision in a way? Like 2000, that must have been a huge, huge decision after 21 years of working together.
Yeah, it was. We started working together. I went back. We split up in about 71. Because I went to Sydney, and then Conrock went bankrupt. And then I started my own business with Roger Davies, actually, who went on to manage, Matt currently manages Pink, Tina Turner and all that. And I went, and then I had the business with Stephen White after Roger went to America. I went back with Gudinski. We started Premier Artists, or I went back and Premier Artists 1975. So I'd basically been with him for 25 years when we split it the second time. We started Frontier in 79. Yeah, it was very hard in 2000, but it was something I had to do. It was, I found I was doing all the work. I was doing all the traveling all of a sudden, where in the earlier days of Frontier, Michael would do all the traveling and I'd put all the shows and promote and put the shows on. So I was doing everything, and I was copping flack from the accountant because I wanted to tour young acts. I mean, you know, I got into trouble for losing 40 grand on Radiohead playing pubs the first time they came. Luckily, they've stayed with me, and whilst they're overdue by about 5 years, do another tour, we've made a lot more than 40 grand. Yeah. So I was copping that. I'd been ill and had to... in the late 90s, I'd been ill, and I spent a bit of time in LA, and I had to get into using computers because the doctors didn't want me on the phone getting stressed out. So I learned about computers, got into them properly, and I learned about the internet, and I really believed the internet. This is 99, 98, 99. I really believed the internet was going to become what it is. What it's become. It was going to be a major, major part. And Michael wasn't interested in that. And we also had a rogue partner who was running the Harbour Agency, and I wasn't happy with that. So I was doing too much work. They didn't want to know about the internet. I wanted this guy gone. Funnily enough, he was actually fired about 8 months after I left. Which if that had been done, I might not have left. And I had Billy Thorpe in my ear going, why are you working with these bastards? They treat you like shit and you're doing all the work. So a Jewish friend of mine, Peter Corder, who's no longer with us, knew Consolidated Press, the Packer thing, very well, and he got me in there, and I decided I'd leave. And of course, Michael, he didn't believe me because I'd been saying it for a few years. So I flew around the world in 24 hours. I saw a major agent in LA, London, New York, all the major players, and told them I was starting and leaving. I flew back to Sydney. I'd been gone 26 hours. I told my PA at the time that I'd been around the world, and I was now flying to Melbourne, and I was finishing up with Frontier. And I got on a plane about 3 hours later and flew to Melbourne, sat in Michael's office and told him I was leaving. And he obviously, you know, Anyway, he flew to Sydney a couple of days later, tried to talk me out of it, but it was too late. I'd done it. And away we went. And I mean, you know, the first couple of tours with Red Hot Chili Peppers and Santana, who that year were the two hottest bands in the world, and I lost money on both of them.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because the dollar crashed to 50 cents and a couple other things. And so here I am, you know, new company, and I lose money on the two hottest bands in the world. It was a great fucking start. But we built it up, and then I'd been in the late 99. I was sitting on the back of a harbour cruise with an agent called Ian Huffam. We bought Blur out and had been very successful. And he was telling me about this guy they were about to announce was going solo, and I worked it out. And I said, oh, not the little chubby bloke from Take That. And it was Robbie Williams. So I was lucky enough to pick up Robbie Williams, and that was incredible.
Well, that 06 tour was a record breaker, wasn't it? Like, that was
600,000 we had. Mm. And then AC/DC broke that record. Yeah, I mean, Robbie, the last tour we did in 2018 was really, really strong. I mean, the guy's one of the best entertainers in the world. And he's sort of now gone into that, across that line, like Elton John and Billy Joel and a few others, where you don't need to have a number one record to pull people, because everybody knows your shows and all your hits. It's an amazing night out.
Yeah,
and Robbie showed that in 2018 when he came back.
And that is where we leave part one of our chat with Michael Chugg. There's a lot more to come. And, wow, he can tell some stories too, can't he? Next week on the podcast, well, where do we start? Hey, you in a black T-shirt? The famous Guns N' Roses Use Your Illusion tour? There's Fleetwood Mac and what happened on the Rumours tour? What was Chuggy having to source for the band? And why was he buying bottles of Heineken? And also, he's going to open up about his last conversation with Michael Gudinski. All next week on the podcast. Follow us now on Instagram, The Rider Pod. Catch you next week. This is The Rider with Becco.